I'm John Zoll, and I'm an Episcopal minister. I serve at a parish in Charleston, South Carolina, called Grace Church. I'm David's brother, and Simeon, who you heard early this morning, his brother, too. Simeon, you probably picked up, is the smartest Zoll, and David is the handsomest, and I am the oldest. In keeping with this outrageous reputation that I apparently have, I want to try something really weird, and just sort of in keeping up with sort of Mockingbird's cutting-edge vibe, I've been asked to give a little talk about addiction and Alcoholics Anonymous and about theology. And in order to do it, I want to do the entire thing, 20 minutes, in the form of a slam poem. So if you're familiar with slam poetry, you'll probably follow and hopefully you'll pick up. Booze. With you I cannot lose, I do choose. Booze. I'm just kidding. I'm totally kidding. I actually hate slam poetry. Although there's a movie called Slam that you could rent. There's a guy named Saul Williams in it who's actually really talented. So there's one slam poet I like, I guess. I'm sure there's some good stuff, but it's not my genre. It's a real treat to be here again at Calvary St. George's for another Mockingbird Conference. This church is very important to me personally. I actually attended preschool at Jack and Jill's, just right out there through those doors. I grew up playing on the least child-proofed playground ever created. Right out there, and it formed me. I also was a member of this church when I first really made the decision to go into the priesthood, and this was also a place where I spent a very formative and important summer in between my second and third year of seminary, learning the ropes of ministry from Nancy Hanna, and so it really helped to shape my ministry, and it's where I first got to experience things like hospital visits and funerals and officiating at weddings and all of that kind of stuff that really makes up the day-to-day work that I now do and love. Most importantly, it's the church where my wife Deirdre and I were married a little over 6 years ago, actually just next door in that beautiful chapel. So I can honestly say that I've had many of the best days of my life right here. And also, because of the ministry of this church to me throughout my entire life, I have been able to have those wonderful days and times and memories and have been shaped very importantly. And that obviously continues to be the case now, thanks in large part to all of these Mockingbird conferences and the ministry of people like Jacob Smith. And the important work and history that has led to our being here today. And I have a personal interest in the well-being and history of this church. In fact, I have on my bookshelf a book in my office in Charleston written by Stephen Ting, who really had a look. You can see a bust of him out there, really an intense nose. Oh, dear. An intense nose, and he was the rector here for a long time in the year 1900, and he wrote a book called Law and Gospel all that time ago. So that's maybe interesting. Thank you. Sorry. But the part of Calvary St. George's history that interests me most has to do with the former rector of Calvary Church, who served here in the 1930s, and his name was Sam Shoemaker. Maybe you've heard of him. He actually wrote a lot of books. And he was very famous in his day, a popular Christian author that many people read with very accessible material. He also was considered by Bill Wilson, the founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, to be the co-founder of AA. And a lot of people maybe aren't aware, but the famous world of Alcoholics Anonymous and AA started right here. Technically, it was born in Akron, Ohio. That's when a guy named Dr. Bob and a man named Bill W. first met. But the 12 steps, which are very famous, actually were first written down just a few blocks away in Sam Shoemaker's office with Bill Wilson. So it's appropriate that I get to talk a little bit about this today, because this place is really one of the important roots of the AA program. I want to describe alcoholism as AA came to understand it. I want to talk a little bit about the universal implications of that particular problem as it relates to the broader traditional Christian teaching about human nature, and the way that such an understanding can reorient our own perspective on human failings. Hopefully, we'll end our time together with a glimpse of legitimate Christian hope and increased compassion for our fellow human beings. In AA, alcoholism is often referred to as a disease. The founders of AA never actually used this term in describing alcoholism. They never said alcoholism was a disease, but they used a similar term, and the term came from a doctor at a nearby hospital named Dr. Silkworth, who introduced Bill W. to the idea that alcoholism in the alcoholic functioned similarly to an allergy. And that term is used even in the original text from 1939, The Big Book. That's the name of the classic AA text, The Big Book, and when I refer to it, that's what I'm referring to. They said that alcoholism was an allergy. And so think for just a moment about what an allergy is. If you have an allergy to nuts, you break out in an allergic reaction whenever you ingest nuts in a way that people who are not allergic to nuts do not experience, right? If one of you is allergic to nuts and I give all of you nuts, only one of you will break out in an allergic reaction. Well, similarly, they believed that some people have this physiological wiring that causes alcoholics to metabolize alcohol in a way that is noticeably different from the way other people process it, that amounts to a kind of physiological reaction that creates in the alcoholic a deep thirst, a kind of, when the alcoholic is exposed to alcohol, a kind of craving develops. This was called in the terminology of Alcoholics Anonymous the phenomenon of craving. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, they came to suggest that alcoholism is a twofold problem. It's a problem of an allergy, and it's the problem of a mind that oddly enough makes it make sense to want to ingest the thing that produces the allergic reaction. So the problem of alcohol involves first the inability to stay away from the first drink, and secondly, the inability to stop drinking once the first drink has entered the system because of the phenomenon of craving. That means, in very short, simple terms, alcoholism is relapse. In a word, the problem of alcoholism is a relapse, meaning it's just as present in the life of the sober alcoholic as it is in the life of the actively drinking sufferer who has this affliction. Now, there are Christian groups that have tried to embrace a lot of AA's material while sort of Christianizing it more. The most famous one comes out of Saddleback Church, Rick Warren's famous church in California. It's known as Celebrate Recovery. It imitates AA in a lot of ways and has a huge amount in common with AA, support groups, all of that. But one of the main things that differentiates Celebrate Recovery from AA is that Celebrate Recovery and many other sort of Christian approaches have rejected what they refer to as the disease model for understanding alcoholism. They don't buy into the idea that alcoholism is an allergy. Because if it is, their theology is not equipped to deal with it. And I want to try to help you to see what that looks like and why AA is, in fact, I think, more insightful and more in line with traditional Christian theological teaching, especially as it was emphasized during the Reformation. Let me turn for a second to a passage that's found in all three synoptic gospels, which means that even the most cynical biblical scholar would bet money that Jesus did, in fact, say these exact words. It's from Mark chapter 2. Jesus said to them, "It is not the healthy who need a doctor, but the sick. I have not come to call the righteous, but sinners." What I want to point out about this passage today is that Jesus does a very odd and rather counterintuitive thing here. You see, he directly equates sin with sickness. Now, that is not the way that people typically think about the human propensity to do wrong. Instead, wrongdoing is typically understood to be a problem related to conscious decision-making, having a lot to do with the brain and a lot to do with willpower and its sort of wrestling match that's going on there. But Jesus, who had such famous and great and history-altering, as J.D. pointed out so eloquently a minute ago, compassion for sinners, I think in this passage he's in fact giving us a clue into how it is that he made sense of people's offenses in such a profound way. Because, you see, he viewed sinners as though they were sick. So let's think about sickness. Sickness takes the decision-making paradigm off the table. It describes a predicament that requires a deeper cure than individual choice. Think about it. When you call into work because you're sick, you're immediately relieved of all responsibility, and you're completely let off the hook. Everyone is quick to absolve a sick coworker, at least if they are legitimately sick. And so we often actually find ourselves using sick days whenever we need an extra personal day or wish to make a choice that is at odds with the expectations of a boss, right? Because it's impenetrable ground. It's sort of the idea. You can't criticize somebody for being sick because they have no control over this problem. In AA, the problem of alcoholism is viewed in a similar light. And because of it, the nature of the religious life in this context becomes a very, very deep thing. It travels beyond the realm of culpability and into the region of prognosis. It concerns itself very little with the brain or the ratio, the rational mind. Religion in AA is understood to have a deeply affective, almost physiological component. I personally believe that this type of religious purview captures a fundamentally crucial element of gospel ministry that is often overlooked. Like Simeon said this morning, understanding the gospel is not simply mental acquisition to propositional assertions about God and Christ. It necessarily involves a kind of, to quote Thomas Cranmer, inward digestion. The gospel is a balm, a kind of medicine that goes to work in all aspects of our waking and sleeping life, our conscious and unconscious life, in our thought life, and also importantly, in our stomach and our guts. True religion, in other words, is not simply affirmed or confessed, it is metabolized. For what it's worth, I think, applying this same train of thought to the realm of ethics, and in particular, immorality, is completely in line with the understanding of human nature that was embraced so deeply by the great thinkers of the Reformation. And more importantly, I believe that thinking about the moral life and the problem of continued trespass, which is just another way of saying sin, in these terms, actually brings us to a place where we can begin to appreciate a bit of the way that Jesus himself actually thought and felt about the world as he looked out upon all of our self-defeat and endlessly futile affairs with performance and agency and ultimately our exhaustion. He saw in us illness and weakness, frogs trying to fly, as Steve Brown puts it. He saw us in the middle of our most regrettable acts, as though we were lying in hospital beds, suffering the symptoms of disease, with the unfazed perception of a great physician, and with the immense tenderness of the most patient nurse. Returning to Sam Shoemaker, consider this wonderful statement about ministry that he made many years ago, just a few blocks away. He said, "Everyone either has a problem, is a problem, or lives with a problem." It's a great quote, and I think it's true. My experience of work in the church has only driven home the point to me again and again. And who cannot relate? Who among you does not currently face some kind of a problem, which is just a circumstance which you seem to be unable to control, something over which you are powerless, to quote AA. It is in this sense that we can all identify with the problem of alcoholism. Do you have stress? Do you experience anxiety, in spite of the fact that you know it's counterproductive and probably irrational? Then you too can begin to see just what it means to be loved by Christ, who reported, thank God, that he had come into the world to save sinners, that he was a doctor for the unhealthy and had come to ease the burden of those who are sick and suffering. To close with, I want to offer an illustration of this kind of compassion, what it looks like on the ground in the world of AA. While it, like all illustrations, can only offer an extremely diluted description of the actual grace that God gave the world in the cross of Christ, it can nonetheless help us, perhaps, to better understand the soteriological dynamic of the gospel, which just means this saving, compassionate work of God on the cross. It can also help us, I think, and this is why I love illustrations so much, to bypass our brains in a way that will hopefully bring our affections and thus our hearts to the surface. Notice, too, as you listen, how the classically reformational elements of law and gospel ministry that are present in the minds of the man telling, or that are so present in our thinking as Mockingbirdians about law and gospel and all of that stuff, how actually the man describing his own story in AA is talking in those terms without even realizing it. I doubt seriously that he's familiar with those categories. One little plug. I wanted originally to show a clip from this movie. It's called Unguarded. It's an ESPN film about a basketball player named Chris Herron, who struggled with a tremendous substance abuse problem and found an amazing resolution through God's grace to that problem. And it is a little like going to an AA meeting if you watch this movie. It'll blow you away, and it's a free instant streamer on Netflix. I totally recommend it if this material interests you or if you're looking to have a little heart moment. Unguarded. So the excerpt I want to share with you, it's found in Grace in Addiction, in the section on step 12, and it comes directly from an AA meeting. These are the words of a man named Dick A., who is a well-known sort of AA circuit speaker from Atlanta, an old-timer of the classic AA variety, meaning he's a bit of a sage. And he is recounting his first encounter with Alcoholics Anonymous back in the late 1970s when he met a man named Ed. And just as a little background, when Ed first met him, he took him to his place, and he kind of wanted to show Dick that there was hope for him. But to Dick's way of thinking, Ed's life didn't look all that impressive. And one of the things that Ed tried to do to encourage Dick was he showed him his brand new Pinto. He thought that was in some way a portrait of hope for the suffering alcoholic. And I don't think Dick was that taken with the prospect of one day maybe I can have a brand new Pinto. But it relates. So these are Dick's words. He says, "So I walked up to the payphone and dialed the number for AA. I started crying, saying, 'I'm an alcoholic.' Instead of rejecting me, she said, 'Just a minute. You wait right there,' and sent out a guy named Ed. I actually resisted listening to him for a while because I thought he wasn't hip like me. I knew that I was just down on my luck. Ed, on the other hand, looked like he'd never had any luck in the first place. But then I saw his eyes. He did what it talks about in the Big Book. He relived the horrors of his past with me. He told me about himself, and he did something that I learned a great lesson from. He asked me about me. He said, 'What do you do?' And I started crying. I said, 'I think I'm an alcoholic.' But he cut me off and said, 'No. What did you do for a living before drinking got the better of you?' And I told him about my writing. He actually recognized some of the things I'd written. And he said, 'That's great stuff. You're very talented. God must really have something in mind for you.' Then I just broke down and started crying. Because no one had said anything kind or hopeful to me in years. And if he hadn't done that, I would not be here sober today. He had read the Big Book, and he understood that we don't get anyone into recovery by being tough on them. But we get people here by unconditional love. They're already hurt, and they've already been through enough hell. We don't need to add to it. We need to let them know there's a place where there's hope. And that's what Ed did for me. After we had talked for a little while, Ed put me into his Pinto to get me something to drink so that he could help me taper off the booze, because I was now starting to vibrate. He realized I was going into delirium tremens because he'd worked with other wet drunks before. He asked, 'Are you going to be okay? I'm going to stop here for just 1 minute to get some money so we can get you on track.' And he got out of the car to use an ATM. It was the first ATM machine I'd ever seen. They were pretty new in 1977. It was a hot day, June the 8th, 1977, in Atlanta. So he goes up to the machine to get his $20 or whatever. And before he can get back to the car, I couldn't get the door open because my hands were rattling so much. And I had thrown up all down the inside of his brand new Pinto. And the only thing that he did when he opened the door and saw what had happened was put his arm around me. He said, 'It's going to be okay.' If he had been critical of me, I wouldn't be here tonight. But Ed knew that we don't have new cars, new jobs, or new lives unless we're willing to work with another alcoholic. And he loved me, and he cared for me, and he took me to a place where I could weather the withdrawals." The rest is history, in so many ways. Thank you.